Blessed is the spot and the house in the place, and the city and the home and the mountain and the refuge and the cave. And the valley, and the land, and the sea, and the island, and the meadow, where mention of God hath been made, and his
we are experiencing technical difficulties.
Yes.
All right. Thank you for coming. My name is Glenn Pierce. This is my daughter, Isabel. And today we're sharing with you our declaration stories. One of us came into the faith from another religion, and the other was born into a faith that eventually required making it her own. I'll start with mine as it happened first in time. Back in 1993, I was a graduate student at Purdue University, and I was a college fundamentalist Christian. So that meant I was Christian when it suited me, and I was very Christian when it suited me, which usually meant it wasn't a Friday or a Saturday night. And in this process, I had hit the point where I was taking a semester off to work in order to afford to go to school for a semester. And in one of those semesters, I was working in the married student housing construction shop. We basically repaired all of the married student housing after people had left after, you know, 3, 5, 10 years in the same unit without reporting a single problem, which meant they ignored every one of the problems. One of the people that I worked with was an electrician named Al Black, and he and I had come to know each other pretty well in terms of the work environment. We were both outspoken, opinionated, and knew how to play euchre without losing. And one day, we were on our lunch break, and he started reading something, so I asked him what he was reading. And he gave probably the absolute best answer you could give to someone with my personality. He said, a book. And so, of course, I pressed him on it. What kind of book? And he said, it's a religious history text. It turned out he was reading volume 3 of Taherzadeh's book on Baha'u'llah's the revelation of Baha'u'llah. I asked him a few more questions about it, and he eventually went to the point of saying that it was on the Baha'i religion. I said, oh, I didn't know you were Jewish. I knew about the Baha'i Berith Center on campus, messing up my understanding of languages other than English or Russian. And so he corrected me and explained to me that that's B'nai B'rith, this is Baha'i, and it's a different religion. I asked him a few more questions, and he said, we're getting close to the end of the lunch hour, we work for a state school, so we're going to have to put this conversation aside. Which, of course, made me want to know more. The next day at work, I ended up asking him at lunch again, pressing him for more information. And he informed me that on Friday evenings at their home, they actually had a social gathering where I could ask any of these questions. It wouldn't be on the state's time, and he wouldn't feel a conflict of interest in meeting his requirements as a state employee and as answering my questions about his religion. So I went, and at this time, he picked the absolute perfect topic. I thought I was going to a social gathering where I could ask him questions. It turned out it was a fireside where he was preparing an answer to the questions I'd already asked. And he set the topic of this fireside as the titles and stations of Baha'u'llah. And he essentially took the passage in God Passes By where Shoghi Effendi goes on to describe all of the titles and prophecy fulfillment-based titles of Baha'u'llah. But he doesn't do it in the same order that Shoghi Effendi does. And so he gives an explanation of the difference between title and station, and uses examples from Christianity and other religions. And then he goes through the titles. And in giving Shoghi Effendi's list, he ended with, to the Jews, he is the Messiah they have been waiting for. To the Muslims, he is the 12th Imam. And to the Christians, he is the promised return of Christ. That concludes tonight's presentation. We have a Scrabble board set up in the other room. We have cards here. There's a chessboard. There are snacks in the kitchen. Thank you for coming. And that was it. So me being the Friday night Christian for the first time in a long time, I was taken aback. I really didn't know how to receive that. I'd never heard anybody claim for the founder of a religion, a real religion, to be the return of Christ. And so we made it through that evening. He put off answering my questions very specifically because we were in the social environment. He lured me into a game of Scrabble. He knew me. But I went home and I decided that I needed to know more. And as I started to learn more about what this Baha'i faith was, I started to become concerned because I'd met his wife. I had met his four children. And I really needed to save them from this man's cult, that he was luring them into a religion, into a false religion. And of course, being the smart, logical, rational person that I was, I knew the best way to beat him was to use the Bible and his own writings. And so I dug into my Bible, dug deep, and pulled every reference I could to things that had been explained to me as the warnings about the return of Christ and claims about the return. But then I read the Kitab-i Iqan as well. And in reading those two, reading my Bible more fully, asking him questions, reading the Kitab-i Iqan, and trying to hit him with trip-ups in his own religion, every single confrontational question, every challenge I posed, Al Black had an answer for. And I didn't always agree with his answer, but he was internally consistent, and his answers weren't Al defending his religion. His answers were Al providing his religion's text answer to my question and leaving it at that. At no point did he tell me, if I don't believe the way he does, I'm going to hell. At no point did he offer it as better than my own religion. He offered it as answers to my questions. For another 4 or 5 months, I gradually made that shift from attacking to save them and into the realm of asking questions to learn more, to truly find out about this religion. And in May of 94, I had reached the point where I realized I had to either accept or reject this religion. And I didn't have the proof that I needed to reject it. I joke, but at the same time I'm completely serious. I became a Baha'i because I failed to prove that Baha'u'llah was a liar. I tried to find anything in his writings that would completely contradict the Bible. And instead it was, no, his answers contradicted my understanding of the Bible, but provided a completely logical and reasonable understanding of the exact same passage that I was trying to use to trip it up. So I got to the point where I had to accept or reject. There was no in-between. He can't be a liar and a good person. This can't be a bunch of good people following a lie. The passage in the Bible where I was told, test the fruits. No corrupt tree can produce good fruit, and no good tree will produce corrupt fruit. I saw plenty of references in the Baha'i writings where Baha'u'llah praises Christ. So the one statement of what Satan can never do, to declare Christ as Lord, Baha'u'llah was doing regularly. So all of the things that were supposed to give me a nice, clean, clear, easy answer weren't happening. So I got up one day and I decided this day would be the last day that I would be investigating this faith, this religion, because I would accept it or reject it. And if I was rejecting it, I was done with it. There's no more to learn. And if I accepted it, it wasn't an investigation. I spent that day in prayer. I spent the day doing the best I could at meditating. And I kept saying, "Dear God, please, if this is a false religion, you have to send me a sign, because everything looks too good to be true, but too true to be anything but good. I need help." And I got no answers the whole day. I went to bed that night angry with myself, because I had set an objective, I'd made a decision that I was going to make a decision, and I didn't. So I went to bed angry with myself. I don't know if it was 30 seconds after I lay down, 30 minutes, or 3 hours. I didn't look at the clock, but I was asleep, and I was dreaming that I was walking along a path, and my mother, who had been dead since 1987, she'd been gone for 7 years. I was walking with her, and we were chatting about the most trivial stuff ever. Nothing important. I don't remember what we were chatting about, but it was unimportant. And we're walking along, and there are woods on either side of the path. Can't go anywhere but forward. So we're just talking and walking. And then we get to a spot where the path splits. And there was this sign post, this old dead tree that was set up as a signpost, and it had, you know, signs pointing both directions. I don't know what they said. I don't remember, or couldn't make them out. But it didn't matter, because there was a log sitting on the path right next to it. And my mom sat down. And I thought, okay, you know, by now she'd be getting kind of old, so she needs to rest. So I sat down next to her, and we finished our trivial conversation. And then I said, "So, Mom, I need to ask you something, because I need some help. I've been looking at this Baha'i faith and the claims of Baha'u'llah, and I can't figure it out. I need some help. Is this a true religion, or is this the absolute best trick Satan has ever pulled on the world?" And she looked at me and she said, "I can't answer that for you. You have to choose your own path." So when I woke up, I knew the Baha'i faith was real. Because if this were a trap, my mother could protect me from it, but she could not choose the right path for me. And so that day, on May 23rd, 1994, on the 150th anniversary of the Declaration of the Bab, I became a Baha'i. And found out that I'd been investigating it ever since. So I didn't stop being a seeker, I just stopped having the uncertainty in the answers that I was finding. That's my story. And I came into the faith from an independent, a much more fundamentalist Christianity. And today, I still find myself to be a born-again Baha'i. And it does fit from how I've embraced this faith. But I came from a very different way than my daughter.
So, obviously, both my parents are Baha'is, and my grandparents, and my whole family were all Baha'is. And so, my family culture has always been, the Baha'i faith is my family culture ever since I was little. I've attended children's classes since I was in preschool. We're very involved with the center here, and basically the Baha'i faith is everything that I do. Even when I was younger and I didn't know that it was like this, everything that I did came through the Baha'i faith first. So because my family culture was just so, it was fluid with both just how we did our daily lives and the Baha'i faith, they were like one. So making the decision of that declaration at 15 of, are you going to be a Baha'i, was, yes, I'm going to be a Baha'i. And I chose to have a celebration, a big ceremony here at the center last November, and where I decided to invite all my friends, the surrounding community, my entire family, which isn't usually done in the Baha'i faith. Some people might have a bigger celebration, but never a ceremony where it was more, I wanted to channel the bat mitzvahs of the Jewish community. And so I wrote a speech, and it was just basically talking about what the Baha'i faith means to me. And I decided to invite my friends because I really feel like my journey wasn't just with me in learning about the Baha'i faith and falling in love with it. I really brought my friends and family along with me. I've invited them to children's classes since we were in first grade. They've attended JYG with me. My dad was one of the animators for that, and we met after school in our classroom. And so they knew what I was talking about and where my love for it was coming from, because we all had a love for it. And so all my friends were there. My family was there. Each of my family gave a speech or a little something to bring and offer to it. And I chose to have a big celebration just because it made me feel like, I don't know, important in the faith too, and kind of telling everyone, like, this is the path that I'm going to take, and telling myself too, and kind of making it official that I'm going to be a Baha'i, and this is the journey that I'm going to take from, you know, I've always been taking a journey, but it's always been just subconscious, and even though we've consciously been talking about Baha'u'llah since I was very young, and singing the songs, it all started from songs when I was little, songs and prayers. And then slowly it moved to children's classes where we would have stories, and then to discussion and full-on talking about why I am a Baha'i with my parents and even my classmates. I've had conversations with them, and those conversations are the ones that have challenged me the most, especially in this day and age. Growing up in my generation, it's like, why are you religious? Because right now there's two sides to it where people will find beauty in the spiritual side of things, and yet they can't fully accept it. And that is something I'm still learning too. And so those are the conversations with my friends that have actually shaped why and really told me why I'm a Baha'i. And it's because I have such clarity in everything I do. And I know myself so well. I can go to school and know why I'm there, and I know why I'm going to choose the career I want, and why I'm going to choose to have a family, because it's all leading up to that, my last moment where I then can go on to the next world, and I will have fulfilled God's wishes here. in the terms of the Baha'i faith. And so, I wanted to have this declaration ceremony just to kind of tell myself and put it in the, I always knew it and my family always knew it, but just to put it there in the world itself, to tell everybody else that this is what I'm doing. So my story is very short. I love that my parents, I felt that having the very structural family dynamic that we had, where we would have bath time and then we'd have story time and then we'd say our prayers, was very similar to the way the Baha'i faith has its rules, and you go to feast and you have your holy days and, you know, you do all of this. And so it was very much the same, you know. I would have dinner, and then maybe that we would go and we'd go to feast, and then we'd come home and we'd do our bath time and story time. And so I was very used to having that, these two worlds of structure, and I knew exactly where I fit in my family and in my faith. And I think that also helped me, because a lot of people, I feel, you know, in this day and age, it's just, there's so little structure in some things that when you're being told what to do, a lot of people don't like being told what to do. And I think that because I've already had this model of family structure, that translated to my Baha'i structure as well. And yet, though, going to feast and going to holy days isn't why I chose to be Baha'i. You know, no one's going to go to feast and be like, I want to do this for the rest of my life. I want to go to feast all the time. Like that, you know, that's just saying some prayers, which are beautiful, but I'm not a Baha'i for the people or the, you know, the refreshments afterwards. I'm a Baha'i because I believe in Baha'u'llah, and he is the, you know, the next manifestation of God, and so I believe in him, and I believe what his message, it's so true, and it just makes so much sense for the world today. Everything he says, he gives an answer. And as a young person, I find that very relieving. And I find much comfort in choosing this Baha'i life. So that's my story.
If anyone has questions, comments for either of us, feel free.
I have, it's so wonderful that you're so blessed to have the experience of the past, you know, your grandfather, your grandparents, your parents being Baha'i. That's really awesome. And then you have that both within the Baha'i frame, the structure, as well as that help is helping you to live with the structure of the world as well. So in what ways do you think that structured living is enabling you also yourself and as well as people that you encounter in their spiritual development as well as yours?
I just think that, you know, my friends I've talked about the Baha'i faith a lot, and so having that the structure at home, and you know, the Baha'i structure and the Baha'i way of life, I know how to respond to people, and so I'll go and I'll talk to somebody, and I became around fifth grade, that was kind of the year that my friends spiritually, I feel, we're starting to question themselves, and so I would get a lot of people coming to me, and even though I didn't always tell them, you know, like, that's not the first thing I go into the classroom to say, like, guys, I'm a Baha'i, I'm, like, really spiritually cool and everything, so, like, yeah, hit me up, but I found that they were drawn to just naturally ask me things about, you know, even the simplest things, like, oh my gosh, I really like this boy, and I was just always because I was experiencing it, experiencing the same thing, but spiritually I had this guide saying, well, not yet, you know, you're only 11, like, let's wait a little bit. So I would just kind of be like, you know, and I think just understanding my role and doing whatever I do and my structure, Baha'i structure, and I never deny, you know, people, especially in high school now, the talk of the girl-boy stuff comes up a lot, and they'll be like, you're seriously never going to do anything before marriage, or anything? And I'm just like, no, I'm not going to. And I think that just having somebody like that, and it helps me to know that I can be this strong. I think it just resonates with everyone, and they can feel that spiritual energy, and that builds not only my spiritual consciousness, but also theirs.
I just wonder about the what for both of you, maybe Isabel first. At what point did you see, for instance, your prayer and meditation life kind of coming more inwardly,
mm-hmm.
and absorbing it more, rather than, you know, kind of out there to do for the community?
For me, that was definitely the year and a half before my 15th birthday, because that's when I really started to think, you know, it's coming up, I always knew that I wanted to have this big ceremony for it, and so I was like, I need to start doing this, and, you know, I always feast, because it was just something I did, I would always have at least, you know, and we always sang our morning prayer in the morning, so I was always, I had prayer, but I think that was 14, 13 and a half, that around that time I really started paying attention to why I'm doing everything, and that I started wanting to do it, not because it was the rules, but because I actually believed in it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's just that knowing that declaration was coming up, and that I don't want to go into it not having had this inward feeling of this is why I'm doing it, so I definitely started. And I think also, I think I must have been 13 when my mom shared the story of Mona to me, and I remember she told it to me, and then I immediately started crying. And I felt for her, and I couldn't stop crying that entire evening. And Keaton was there, and he was like, she crying, because, you know, if I had known that story at his age, you know, it wouldn't have been as impactful, but I was in such a stage in my adolescence, I think, 13 and 12, 13 and 14, I feel is a very important, those years as a Baha'i, because it's leading up to this big moment. If you're raised Baha'i, that 15, you're going to sign your card, and I was like, that, she is in my shoes as a Baha'i, and I think having Mona, learning the story early on at 13, and then reading the book that came out by Azadeh, that, like, reading that, I'm like, okay, you know, this is the path I want to take. I start saying my prayers. I want to strive to be Mona and be that pure and be the Mona of this generation, among other, you know, and I hope that everyone can channel her energy.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably when it started. Mm-hmm.
Thanks. And then for you, it's like, I mean, I'm sure you were praying before you became Baha'i, but
mm-hmm.
it's more of like, whether it's the Lord's Prayer, but there's like a tradition of personal prayer in Christianity, and how did that evolve into the potency of Baha'u'llah's prayers and tablets?
So I grew up Catholic, Roman Catholic, but I grew up Roman Catholic, the son and living with a divorced mom. So her approach to the church for me was very different than her parents' approach to the church for her. I went to church with my mom until I told her I didn't want to go. It was never a forced thing. And along the way, I did have, so everything was delayed. I did First Communion not at age 8, but at age 13, when you should be starting to think about confirmation in the church instead. So I was older than all of my classmates in First Communion class. I had developed a rebellious teen relationship with the church itself. But it was my freshman year of college. My mother committed suicide. And after going through the grieving process, not only with regard to her death, but with regard to my relationship with God, that summer, I was pretty much at the bottom. I was getting high when I wasn't getting drunk. And the son of my high school math teacher encountered me out one day, and he invited me to a talk that night on evolution, and said, I know you believe in evolution. Most of the people that are going to be at this talk don't, and it is about a biblical understanding of evolution. So you can be my guest evolutionist. And so I went to it. Ultimately, he returned me to a relationship with Christ that I was on a dead-end spiral away from. And that summer is when my owning my faith, instead of inheriting it, became normal. However, I was still a college student, and as I said, I became a very on-fire Christian at those moments that I wasn't a lukewarm Christian. And it was, I was all running all the way hot, or the bottle in front of me was more important to me that night. But that approach to my religion is what set the stage to my relationship with Al Black's religion and making it my own. That I had to accept it or reject it. There wasn't room for, oh, that's a decent philosophy, because it wasn't claiming to be a philosophy.
Thank you both for being here. Isabel, do you have, in those of us raised in the South in a Christian culture, we have this whole 7 days and Sunday kind of day. Do you have a consciousness of 19 days as a chunk, or is it still like the 7 day week, or is it some weird mixture?
Yeah, I don't really, because I don't look at, when the next feast is necessarily.
Oh, you just wait until you come.
Yeah,
yeah, until
it comes. And so, but we do have Sunday children's classes in Soul Cafe here, and I think that I definitely look forward to it. I mean, I love the idea of being coming together and talking about, like, finally being able to talk about the Baha'i Faith with Baha'is. And I think that I don't have one of those, wait to pray and to, get rid of our sins on that day.
On that day.
Yeah, I try and keep it.
Do you ever
it.
Think there'll be a day when you think in 19 days increments?
I'm not
in
sure.
Your lifetime?
Right now I am, because the next feast is the day before school starts. So now I'm dreading it.
Question two is, what are your opinions about racial equality and prejudice? I mean, does racial prejudice even make any sense at all? I mean, or is,
I know.
Am I asking a question right? Because
we want to prejudice for generations. Did we do it? Did we accomplish our goals?
Yeah, I think maybe that's the
In a Baha'i sense, or just in?
In general. I mean, with your classmates or whatever.
Well, I've thought about this question so much, because we are in a strange time right now where we've we're no longer being silent about anything, and we're trying, you know, we have half, it's just so muddled, and you're just like, there's so much good in the world, and yet we're constantly seeing things going on. We're like, how is this happening? And so I've always had this question in my mind since throughout middle school. So in eighth grade, I did a report, a race unity report from the Baha'i writings. We had to do an eighth grade project, and that was, I chose mine. And so I put on a workshop, and it was just, I didn't even, this part wasn't through the Baha'i writings. I just basically educated myself first and then others, and the whole middle school came, and it was just learning what racism is and identifying yourself and just where you stand in this place. And I go to a predominantly white school, so it was also talking to white kids about racial prejudices, and we talked about white privilege in this workshop. So I think that the fact that I could come with a bunch of between 11 and 14 year olds and have a conversation about race where there was not a single person who didn't take it seriously, who didn't joke about it and took it seriously. And, you know, I would give them a survey at the beginning and they crossed off what they knew about race, and it was questions like, what is white privilege? You know, do you think that this scenario, and I'd give a scenario, is racist, or, you know, and then I gave them the same survey at the end, and they took it, and not a single person was like, I don't really want to fill out this form, like, you know, I think that's saying a lot, that they came, and the fact that I had, out of the 45 middle schoolers, I go to a very small school, that 30, I had 30 RSVP and 39 showed up. And afterwards, I posted on Instagram a little picture and was like, thanks for coming to my workshop, everybody, my little 14-year-old self. And I had 7th graders commenting, and a lot of them were the guys, and I was surprised, because a lot of the times girls are the empathetic ones, you know. A lot of the guys were like, thank you so much, I learned so much, this was amazing, it was so fun. And I was, you know, I think that definitely this generation is, I think we're consciously more involved in changing that, and the racial, we're just, it's an intuitive thing. And I think that we, this generation, can talk about it more of in the sense of, oh, this is happening, and like, we're gonna just not talk about it, and we'll like make jokes about it, but we're really like conscious of it. And I think, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Isabel, so you've been a part of the GU Youth Program, right?
Yeah.
What do you feel like, what impact has that had on your development, and how do you feel the GU Youth Program can help the future of the Baha'i Faith?
Mm-hmm. So I love the GU Youth Group. My only thing with the GU Youth Group is that it invites, you know, a lot of people who aren't necessarily Baha'is, and I love that, because obviously that's how we're growing. And one thing I love about Soul Cafe is a lot of Baha'i kids come, so that's how I'm able to kind of talk with Baha'is. But the JYG curriculum itself is a beautiful way to bring kids together, especially I love the children's class program, because it's so much easier to talk to children about it. So I think the junior youth group, when I was in it, all my friends have gone through it, my close friends. And so I think I wish that more kids would invite their friends to it, because I can talk to my friends and they know they love the Baha'i Faith. I just invited them to a book one session this past school year. It was an overnight thing, and we did the whole entire book, and it was the one, you know, that one's so powerful because it's all about life after death. And I, you know, they weren't talking about it as if they're kind of like, okay, you know, this is a Baha'i thing. They were talking about it as if this is what is happening. And so I think the junior youth group stuff is very impactful, because if they I don't know if they had gone to, if they hadn't gone to JYG before that point, if they would have the same understanding of who Baha'u'llah is, who Abdul Baha is, even though the JYG program doesn't necessarily completely talk about those two figures. They know the Baha'i faith, and I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if in the future one of my friends became a Baha'i, and that I love seeing the JY in the communities getting together, and I love the program.
I have a question. So there's a generational aspect to these stories. Do you have a recognition of his story? And then do you know Al's story? And where do you go? How far back have you done any tracing of the spiritual connections between your folks?
So for myself first, my understanding of the history of my taught the faith history stops with Al. I don't know the names of the people associated with him, but he went to Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana in the 70s. And Ball State University in the 70s was very much a college in the 70s environment. He, when the codification came out, the synopsis of Kitab-i Aqdas, he was one of the many Baha'is that they cut their hair because they saw that, it is unseemly for men to have their hair grow beyond the lobe of their ears. And then the next year, when the Universal House of Justice explains that, oh no, this isn't binding on the Baha'is in the West. But the hair was already short. So I don't think he had a spiritual individual. I think it was the Baha'i community in Muncie, because he hasn't spoken to me about an individual the way I know he would have, if that's how the connection was.
Is he still around?
He's in South Carolina. He lives in Columbia now. His daughter lives over in Raleigh and has worked for Charles in her early Montessori career.
And for Isabel, please, what's your understanding of the effect of his story on you?
Yeah, this is the first time I've heard it all the way through, and this fully. I've heard pieces of it. I've known the name of Al before, and this is just the first time I've heard it all the way through. I think it's very, having my mom grow up in the faith, and then my dad join the faith, I think it gives a very beautiful perspective, because it's very different to grow up in something than to find it yourself. And I sometimes wish that I would have that journey. I'd be able to find something so beautiful, because that's when you know that, I mean, that is when you know you're a Baha'i, is if you can go from some, especially, going from another religion where it's saying, Jesus Christ is, this is the way, to then be like, well, I think this is now another way, and this is the new path. So I think that's, I love hearing stories about seekers, and so I think that has been impactful, of just knowing that my father, he made this decision, at especially that age, were you even 25?
Yeah? I was 24.
Okay. He hadn't reached the, brain maturity. The brain maturity yet. So, like...
We still haven't got it.
Yeah. So the fact that at that age he could make such a really mature decision is very... I admire that a lot. So always knowing that he came from a past of church and not church, sometimes going to church, sometimes not, and then making this decision to follow Baha'u'llah is definitely impactful on why I chose to become a Baha'i. And why I feel so blessed at the same time that I don't have to, make all my mistakes as a high schooler and then finally be like, oh, I shouldn't have done that. Like, this is the way now. I can be like, straight path all the way.
Thank you.